Ms. Dernbach making and starting off the presentations.
Good evening, Dr. Horn and board members. I'm Lisa Dernbach. I'm a senior engineering geologist with the board's South Lake Tahoe office, and I'll be presenting agenda item number 3, which is a status report on activities concerning chromium contamination for the PG&E Hinkley Compressor Station. So, in my report tonight, I'll be providing an update to the board on the second quarter 2014 chromium plume map and summary. I'll also describe the notice of applicability that was issued for PG&E's agricultural treatment units. I'll update you on the in situ remediation that was mentioned several times in the prior agenda item, as well as a pilot test that's been proposed by PG&E for a bioreactor. I'll give a little explanation about what that is. I'll inform you what the status is of the supplemental environmental project, as well as the contract status for the U.S. Geological Survey's chromium background study. And then I'll present the next actions that we are considering for this project. So first off is the chromium plume summary, and the most recent one we have is for second quarter 2014. And generally the plume on the plume map that we receive quarterly, it was slightly smaller in second quarter compared to first quarter. We saw that over in the Hinkley Gap area, the northern plume, which was originally one large plume in the north, has been divided now into two separate plumes, and I'll show that to you on the map in a moment. And in addition to the main plumes that we see, we also saw areas of what we call little plumelets, which are areas of chromium concentrations above background but not attached to the main plumes. And there was one in the northern portion of Water Valley, also called Harper Dry Lake, and I'll show you where that one was. But some of the more notable monitoring well information in the second quarter was that for monitoring well 193S3 in the Harper Dry Lake area, it showed a 20% decrease in chromium-6 compared to first quarter. So second quarter, the concentration was at 220. Previously, it was at 270 parts per billion. And I'll point out that location in the next slide. But down in the source area where we still have the highest concentrations of chromium, at one point where we've always seen the greatest levels, which is monitoring well 05D, it increased to 7,200 parts per billion in second quarter compared to 4,600 where it was in first quarter. What we see is that this well goes up and down, and it usually is depending upon the in situ remediation actions being implemented there at the source area. For monitoring well information, what we saw in second quarter is that there were 9 domestic wells. I said monitoring wells, and I meant domestic wells. There were 9 above the maximum background levels of 3.1 parts per billion chromium-6 and 3.2 parts per billion total chromium. The domestic well that showed the most, the highest chromium-6 detections was at 4.8, and that domestic well was located on Mulberry Road, and it was one of the little plumelets, not attached to the main plume. But most of the domestic wells in this category were in the 3 to 4 parts per billion range. Lastly, want to let you know that Water Board staff mailed out 10 letters in July to property owners in the northern area where we have PG&E under board orders to better define the chromium plume, but PG&E has informed us they're having problems getting access to private properties for installing monitoring wells. So we sent out these letters hoping that people maybe might be a little more open to considering PG&E's request. And I don't have the results of those 10 letters. Maybe you can ask PG&E when they come up after me if they've heard from any of those parties. So here we have the chromium plume map for second quarter 2014. And down at the southernmost, we see the solid green line. That's what we call the plume core, which is attached to the compressor station and the source area. And then that core plume is detached or separated from another plume in the northern Hinkley Valley, which is detached from still another plume in the Harper Dry Lake Valley. And way at the very north, you see a teeny little dashed green circle. That's the plumelet we were talking about in one area at Monitoring Well, I think 184. And then way back down in the core plume area to the east and west are also two little small circles, dashed lines, where we have concentrations above the background levels but not attached to the plume core. So we see these, and sometimes they fluctuate in quarters. But I guess the message I would like to say is the first point made is that we're just seeing a slightly decrease in size of the chromium plume this quarter compared to the last. So let me bring you up to date on the notice of applicability for PG&E's agricultural treatment units. As you're aware, the board adopted waste discharge requirements for PG&E at the March board meeting. And very soon after that, PG&E submitted a report of waste discharge to the board. And back and forth conversation with board staff, they also submitted several addenda to us. And we finally deemed that the report of waste discharge was complete. And in August, just last month, the executive officer issued a notice of applicability for PG&E to begin that project. Just a couple points we staff made in the notice of applicability. We clarified some comments. Some were about the monitoring and reporting program, and one was about the EIR mitigation measures that PG&E was to implement with the project. So we put that in to make it clear to everyone and the public what was expected during the project's implementation. So this notice of applicability authorized PG&E to construct their agricultural treatment units over 321 acres out of the total 500 acres that was allowed in the waste discharge requirements. The construction of these new ATUs will begin this fall, very shortly, and we're told that discharge will begin in the spring next year, 2015. And we understand from PG&E that they've already started the EIR monitoring baseline for in domestic wells. They sent out letters to domestic well owners that were in the proximity of where their ATUs were going to be operating. And I understand that the sampling of those domestic wells will include the chromium, the TDS, nitrate, uranium, and the water levels, which will evaluate how much drawdown is occurring in those wells, if any. So this map shows where the new ATUs that were allowed in the notice of applicability. It's the dark green ones, so two down here in the southern area, just north of the compressor station. And then up here at the ranch, the light-colored green shapes are fields that were already existing and in operation. And then that dark green square shape is going to be the new expanded ranch project. Let's jump to in situ remediation. It's been a while since we kind of talked about this with you because We haven't had any new permits in front of you, but we thought since we know that you're going to be hearing a lot about it during these cleanup and abatement order discussions, you should kind of have a little understanding of where we are in that project. We noticed in the quarterly monitoring reports that there tend to be limited treatment occurring in some of the IRZ areas. So we asked PG&E to submit to us a status report and discuss where treatment wasn't being as effective. And the status report stated that a lot of that limited treatment was due to clogged injection wells, as well as some tighter soils that were being found in the IRZ areas. I added this photo last night because we talked about biofouling or biological fouling of wells, and I thought that this picture would give you a clear understanding. I don't know if all of you can see it, but that orange slime is actually a mass of dead and living bacteria. In this case, the orange color tells you it's iron-reducing bacteria. And what it's doing is it's reacting to the ethanol that's being injected to the well and being pushed out into the environment to convert the chromium-6 to chromium-3. Well, the little bugs in the ground are kind of interfering with the process. And if there's no maintenance occurring on that well to clean it out, that well will just eventually completely clog up, allowing no more ethanol to even get in or out into the environment. So this is the type of activities that we want to see PG&E stay on top of and not wait until they get bad, but do it as a routine maintenance so that there's a constant ethanol being injected into the environment, so that we have a nice, steady cleanup reaction going on in the IRZ area. So PG&E informed us that they have a maintenance program to try and prevent this from occurring in the future. But as I said, some of the wells ended up being completely clogged and not rehabilitatable, if that's a word. So the enhancements proposed by PG&E is that they're going to first install wells in the source area to try and investigate how much chromium is remaining in certain areas. And then after that, install new injection wells to replace the clogged injection wells. And then also install new injection wells at closer spacing where you saw earlier in the program there was some striping or streaking going on. And so the ethanol was not dispersing laterally like had been predicted. And therefore, we think tighter spacing for the injection wells. And PG&E is proposing that in a couple areas. And one last proposal is that they want to expand the IRZ treatment in the southwest portion of the source area. And I'll show you where that is. Oh, before I leave the slide, just out of, it was mentioned tonight a couple times, manganese. If this slime mass had a black color instead of this rust colored, then we would know that this was a manganese reducing bacteria. This is a map showing the in situ remediation area at the compressor station, which we call the source area. And that's that kind of yellow square in the middle there. And as mentioned earlier, the different colors of blue and gray shade depict the chromium concentrations, with the highest chromium being this dark, I'll call it purple, here. And we're seeing remediation where it's lighter color, yellow or white, here and here, and definitely nice white here. That means the chromium's been remediated very nicely, either to non-detect mostly, or to just at least less than 3.1 parts per billion for the background level. But we had concerns in this box, this rectangle in the southwestern area, because the ethanol was not dispersing laterally. We weren't seeing the treatment. And of course, there's a fine line to be held because PG&E didn't want to disperse it too widely because on the left side of the slide, you see this. There's a ranch there with two domestic wells. So PG&E is proposing to expand the IRZ treatment inside this rectangle box to try and remediate that
blue area you see is chromium above 100 parts per billion. But that expansion is still within the current WDR we have for this project. So it's expanded above the current project, but still within the permit limit. So it won't require any new permitting, and we think it will have a lot of benefit. The other area you see in the middle of the slide is a very long rectangular box. That's where the current ethanol injection wells exist along that line. And so this is the line where the replacement injection wells will go. And then there above that is a square box, and there's a couple dots in that box, and that's showing where new monitoring well goes to try and evaluate how much chromium is remaining, because that's the real hot spot where that 7,000 parts per billion remains, mostly in the deep area. And we want to make sure, you know, is that being caused either by tighter soils or maybe just the lack of the microbes in that area. So we're going to, you know, make sure that whatever is causing that limitation, that it's evaluated as much as possible, because that's been a real stickler, that hot spot area. But as I mentioned earlier, it kind of goes up and down in concentration each quarter, depending on whether it's being affected by remediation or not. One more area where PG&E is proposing the enhancements, and in this slide you see another blob here, I'll call it, the dark purple, and that's in the deep zone, and there's been very limited movement of the ethanol in this. And PG&E, this is where PG&E is going to propose the additional closer spacing injection wells. So try and get overlapping of that ethanol injection so we don't have areas of that striping where there's been no cleanup in between. And again, all of this is going to be within the current permit, so we're not planning to bring anything back to you for additional approval. The reason I wanted to go into detail on that is board staff has drafted a letter with our concerns that we plan to submit to PG&E, but before that, tomorrow, we're going to hand that draft letter to the Community Advisory Committee and let them look at it and tell us if they have any concerns about our comments, if they like what we say or don't like what we say, or what maybe other recommendations they think we should put in that letter. So we're trying to do this back and forth with the community rather than, say, issue letters and then get reactions from the community afterwards. Try and get everyone kind of on the same page. Maybe not, you know, not that we have to agree with everything, but just kind of be open and upfront on what we're thinking and where we're heading prior to those comments going out. So a number of times tonight you heard mention a bioreactor. Well, PG&E submitted to us a proposal to do a pilot test in the in-situ remediation area for the bioreactor. And this is also something that's been allowed under the current permit for this area. And what PG&E is proposing is an above-ground bioreactor where they will pump out groundwater containing chromium, initially at a rate of 5 gallons per minute. And they're going to bring on site these two big storage tanks or vessels. And in the first storage tank, the extracted groundwater will be subjected to acetic acid, which is vinegar, and also phosphoric acid, and that will cause the reduction of chromium-6 to chromium-3. After that, the water will go to the second storage container, and it will go through an aeration process through a layer of rock and then sand gravel. And what that will do is, remember the byproducts that we mentioned earlier? That will remove those byproducts. And if any chromium that had precipitated out wasn't removed in the first storage tank, it'll be removed in this storage tank. So PG&E is proposing to do this and monitor along all stages of the process. And eventually, the treated groundwater will be returned to the aquifer back uphill, up gradient, so that if it wasn't a complete reaction, there's still some remaining chromium, well, then it'll go through the IRZ process and be treated with ethanol so that the process will be completed. If this 6-month pilot test at 5 gallons per minute is successful, then they'll propose to expand it and increase the rate to 20 gallons per minute and operate that for a couple months and then submit to us a report, because this was one of the technologies discussed in the EIR as a way maybe to get the chromium out of the ground and maybe remove from the environment rather than just converting it to chromium-3 and then leaving it in place. We've already issued our comments to PG&E on this process. We didn't approve it or disapprove it. We just said we need a little more information. And just this week, we got comments from the Community Advisory Committee on maybe some things more we can ask for PG&E on that project before we do our final evaluation. So let me update you on the supplemental environmental project. This is the one that the board approved in March 2013 for PG&E to use administrative civil liability funds to upgrade the Hinckley School water system. So all planning and designs have been completed, and the project's construction started about a year ago. And in 2014, most of the activities revolved around installing 2 new water supply wells by the Mojave River and connecting a water line from those new wells to the water line that was already in place from the compressor station north to the school. So that has been completed. And at this time, I believe they're doing testing and shakedown. And after that's been completed, if everything is all acceptable, primarily to the county, which regulates the school as a small community water system, then the system will be turned over to the school district either the end of this year or early 2015. The final project I want to inform you is about the contract status for the U.S. Geological Survey's chromium background study. Board staff worked diligently last winter to put together a contract request package, and that was submitted to the State Water Board in late March 2014. We are still awaiting for the state boards to complete the review, and afterwards it'll be forwarded to the USGS for signing. Staff is in almost daily contact with the state board and is optimistic that forwarding to the USGS might even occur this week. So let's keep our fingers crossed. So the next actions we're proposing for this project. Regarding the background study, of course, continue overseeing, making sure that contract keeps moving forward and gets signed so that the background study can get started as soon as possible. In addition, staff agrees to continue working with the technical working group and attend meetings as much as we can to work out some of the technical issues of the background study. And then for the cleanup and abatement order, you heard in the prior presentation the timeline that was presented, where we're going to come back in November and then draft a CAO that will be released in early 2015 and then distribute that for public comment and come back maybe next spring, if all works well, for the final adoption. At this time, we're not working on any further waste discharge requirements. We haven't had any proposals by PG&E for the in-situ remediation area indicating we need new requirements issued. So we're staying within the current footprint of the WDR that we have. And so we'll just kind of see how that goes in the future, but keep it on the back shelf if necessary. So at this time, I'll ask if you have any questions, and then after I answer your questions, Mike Plasiak of the Vicar Bell office will come up and update you on the Water Board's nitrates study and testing that's being done in Hinckley.
Board members have any questions for Ms. Dernbach?
No.
Mr. Dyer?
Yes, thank you. Lisa, on slide 4, you indicated that we seen a decrease in chromium 6 concentration, 20%, for monitoring well 193-S3.
Yes.
Do you think this decrease is simply due to dilution, or is there something going on?
We honestly don't know, because we don't know if that high area of concentration is related to the compressor station release or if it's natural. It is going to be studied as part of the USGS background study. It's an unusual concentration to be seen up there in the Harper Lake Valley, where typical of the concentrations we're seeing up there are mostly single digits, a few teens, but that one in the 200 level really took everyone back. It was completely unexpected. So we just really don't know what it's attributed to now and what its decrease is attributed to.
Okay. Later in your presentation, when you were discussing ethanol injections.
Yes.
I just wonder if we have a target concentration we're trying to achieve in the groundwater of TLC, and can you tell me what that is?
I cannot tell you what that target concentration is. I would have to refer to PG&E.
Okay, because when we were discussing the last item, mention was made of various concentrations in the modeling of either 1.0 milligrams per liter or 0.1. One final question. In the discussion of the bioreactor, after reduction of chromium from 6 to 3, in the second stage, we're trying to remove iron and manganese. Is that correct?
That's correct, and I should have mentioned that in that first vessel, when the chromium reduction occurs, I'm told that when the chromium 3 becomes a solid, it's supposed to settle to the bottom of the vessel, and at that time it'll accumulate and be removed off-site at some point in the pilot test. So there's two chances for chromium removal, either in the first storage tank or the second one.
Oh, that's good. That answers the question about returning the treated water to the aquifer. I thought it still had the chromium in it.
Well, only if the process isn't complete in converting the chromium 6 to the solid phase. If it's still in the chromium 6 dissolved phase, yes, it will go back to the aquifer.
And I'm a little confused as to how the iron and manganese are removed. I thought they remain in solution, but evidently they precipitate out.
Right. When in the first vessel, when the acetic acid and the phosphoric acid is put in to reduce the chromium, it also reduces the other metals that are also in the dissolved phase. So typically what we see is the iron, the manganese, will turn to the solid phase, and then in the second vessel is where they're going to be filtered out. So eventually, one of our questions that we have for PG&E on the bioreactor is, at what point will that sand and gravel filter, you know, be filled up with all these precipitates, and it'll have to be either changed out or removed, or will it be able to go on for the entire pilot test before any change happens?
Or backwashed in some way?
Yes, right.
Okay, thank you, Lisa.
All right.
I have no questions, so thank you very much. Mr. Plaziak.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Horn, board members, public. I'm Mike Plaziak, supervising geologist in the Victorville office. Let's see if we can get this going here. All right, I have just one slide, so I'll make it very brief. My brief will be brief tonight. Early this year, staff in the Victorville office got some data from PG&E that was nitrate data. And what we found from the data that there are two hot spots in Hinckley. In fact, in these two hot spots, the nitrate concentrations nitrate is in exceeds 150 milligram per liter. Recall that the drinking water standard is 10. So they're fairly high. We looked at those data. Now we know where the data are because of the PG&E monitoring network. What staff did then was look at land uses in the area. We've seen that the agriculture and dairies have been present in Hinckley for well over 40, 50 years. So what we did was we expanded and looked at a risk assessment for all those domestic wells that are outside the PG&E monitoring network to assess whether there are any receptors, any people that are out there drinking water, that it's above the drinking water standard for nitrates. So this is not related to the hexavalent chromium work that's going on. This is a focus primarily on nitrates. And so what we did was we focused in area number one during July and June and July of this year, collected some data. We did find some domestic wells that exceeded the drinking water standard, provided letters and fact sheets to the residences. Now we've completed that area, and then just as a heads up, in that area is we do have a dairy, Harmson Dairy, but we focused a little bit downgrading and outside of the area that Harmson is currently, I should say, they have an investigative order, or actually a cleanup and abatement order for them to collect water samples from residents down gradient, and for those that exceed drinking water standard, they're providing replacement water now. So we expanded beyond that network. So that's what we've done. We've completed area one. We'll move to area two during the end of this month and also go into October time frame. And then later on in the fiscal year, we'll go into area three. So that's our plan, and we will be addressing this at the Community Advisory Committee meeting on the September 25th to also bring this to the public's attention. And for those that aren't, that do live in the area, please get the word out that we would like to. We'll be sending letters out to residences in area number two here shortly to ask for permission to sample those domestic wells. So if you know anybody in those areas, let them know that we'll be contacting them at some point in time. So we'd like to get an assessment of who else is outside of the PG&E monitoring network that might be drinking water that's impacted by dairy or ag operations. That concludes my brief. Are there any questions?
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Plasiak. I think next up we have Mr. McCarthy. And I'm wondering, are you going to turn his podium around? He should be facing, I don't know, the audience more than the board. What's your thought, Patty?
I think he's fine.
Because
everyone else.
Do you want a remote microphone where you can stand?
Sure. I can stand like this.
So you need to introduce yourself.
Good evening, Dr. Horn, members of the board, members of the public present. My name is Sean McCarthy with the State Water Resources Control Board, Division of Drinking Water. I'm the district engineer for the local field district office in San Bernardino. As you know, the Division of Drinking Water was formerly part of CDPH until July 1st of 2014, and the final regulation which we adopted under CDPH before moving to the State Board was the MCL for hexavalent chromium. It's my pleasure tonight to present you this update on the final regulation package and shed some light on the process we followed for adoption of the MCL. In a nutshell, this depicts California's rulemaking process. The reg development's process is lengthy and a bit complicated, and as you can see from the slide, it's not really clear. But there are a number of steps in the state agency must follow as it follows through the regulatory adoption process. One of the reasons for this is because of the legislator's desire to ensure public participation throughout the adoption process through public meetings, public comment periods, and responses to comments. State agencies like CDPH are given legislative authority to adopt regulations for drinking water and specific primary drinking water standards. This authority is found in the Health and Safety Code, specifically the California Safe Drinking Water Act. Our statutory authority in the Health and Safety Code requires primary drinking water standards to be set at a level that is as close as feasible to the public health goal, placing primary emphasis on the protection of public health, and that to the extent technologically and economically feasible, avoids any significant risk to public health. Therefore, as a result, the public health goal, along with these technological and economic considerations, are important factors when considering adoption of a primary drinking water standard. As you are aware, the public health goals are established for contaminants in drinking water are established by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, or OEHA. They played a critical role in the development of the hexavalent chromium MCL by performing a health risk assessment of the exposure of chromium 6 to establish the PHG at a negligible risk level considering cancer and non-cancer health effects. For chromium 6, this final PHG of 0.02 parts per billion was based on no more than one person in a population of 1 million developing cancer if they drank 2 liters of water every day for 70 years. To put this in another way, if a community of 1 million people each drank 2 liters of water at the PHG for 70 years, it is estimated that no more than one person might get cancer. It doesn't mean that one person will get cancer. In fact, no one person may. What the PHG and the negligible risk level tells us is that out of that 1 million population, 999,999 people or more will not get cancer if they drink 2 liters of water at the PHG for 70 years. It's important to understand that this is a negligible health risk level, and OEHA's guide to public health goals clearly states that the public health goal is not a boundary line between a safe and dangerous level of a contaminant in drinking water. And drinking water can still be considered acceptable for public consumption even if it contains contaminants at levels exceeding the public health goal. As I stated earlier, the Health and Safety Code requires us to set the MCLs as close as feasible to the public health goal, as technically and economically feasible. For this reason, our reg development process included an extensive cost-benefit analysis at various candidate MCLs, which took into a number of considerations, including the occurrence data of chromium 6 levels found in the state, both naturally and man-made, the feasibility of treatment technologies to remove chrome 6, and the cost of those treatments, costs of monitoring and contaminant removal, as well as the potential population affected by the rule. Through this reg development process, the drinking water program proposed an MCL of 10 parts per billion in August of 2013. The MCL was open for public comment from August 23rd to October 11th, 2013, and included two public hearings. About 18,000 comments were received during this comment period, which were summarized and responded to as required by law for the final regulation adoption. These responses and our analysis for the MCL adoption can be found in the final statement of reasons of the regulation package, which is on the website here. The final regulatory package for the MCL of 10 parts per billion was adopted in April of 2014, and in accordance with state law, became effective on July 1st, 2014. The MCL applies to applicable public water systems regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act. It is the first MCL in the country specific to hexavalent chromium. Up until then, hexavalent chromium was regulated under the total chromium limit of 50 parts per billion in California, which was already the most stringent in the country. This new MCL further lowered California's previous limit for hexavalent chromium by 80% and is one-tenth of the current federal limit for total chromium in water of 100 parts per billion. Now, looking ahead, the division will continue to follow new scientific evidence on the health effects of hexavalent chromium exposure, as well as changes in treatment technologies and their associated costs. Changes in these or the public health goal can lead to revisions in the MCL in the future. In addition, US EPA is currently considering establishing a hexavalent chromium-specific MCL and is in the process of gathering information. Now, should US EPA establish an MCL lower than 10 parts per billion, California will then adopt that standard or one that is lower. And that concludes my presentation tonight, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. McCarthy? Mr. Dries? Mr. Pumphrey?
No.
Ms. Haas?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming to our meeting tonight.
You're welcome.
Next up is PG&E.
Good evening, Kevin Sullivan again for PG&E. I'll give you a fairly brief update. Lisa Dernbach did the heavy lifting and summarized most of the activities, but I'll just follow up a little bit. She had it being issued on the 1st. I think we got it in the mail on the 4th, so there's a little discrepancy in the dates, but we have been working very diligently on the AU expansion. I want to the process to get that permit and that notice of applicability, I think, was longer than we all expected. There were a lot more details due to the EIR and the complexity of some of the mitigation requirements, but that is behind us. We have the notice of applicability. I understand from one of our engineers, Ian Baker, who's here tonight, that we actually have got the expansion of the ranch. The physical structure is up. We still have to condition the soil, pull some things out. So we're still striving for summer before us. I guess the equinox on the 21st. We'll be close. We were hoping to have that in June, but we're working it to meet schedule. The next one in the queue will be the Community East AU, and we're hoping to have that online before it gets too cold this winter. It'll be close. It'll basically depend on the weather. So there's a lot of work going on out at the site to expand these agricultural units as we discuss. So we're pretty excited about that. That'll increase the amount of water that we can pump to contain the plume and then also start to treat some of the higher concentrations. The baseline sampling is underway, and so we have based on the EIR, which was certified earlier, very clear prescriptive requirements on establishing baseline conditions for both water level and byproducts, so that we don't have the problem that we faced in the past where we're wondering what it looked like before we started a new remediation. So that sampling is underway. It is. Most of them are multiple quarters of sampling required, and it'll give us a good understanding of where we stand now for both byproducts of the various remediations, both the IRZ byproducts, manganese and arsenic, as well as potential ag unit byproducts and drawdown of the aquifer. We've had, I'd say, a mixed bag of responses from residences. We've had a good number who have allowed us to access, and then there are others who have been less responsive. So we're continuing to monitor that, and we'll be looking at substituting monitoring well data in certain areas we can't get access. A lot of other site activities going on. Again, as Lisa mentioned, the SEP project, the Supplemental Environmental Project, that's the water to the school, that is close to done. There's been a lot of very long freshwater line installed. We've been doing a lot of the mitigation tasks related to the agricultural units. There's a lot of different plans, like raven management plans, biological management plans. This is a document that kind of changed the game for us in terms of how easy it is for us to just go out and kind of respond quickly and do things. We have a lot more boxes that need to be checked. And I think I think the board staff and the PG&E staff have been working pretty collaboratively to work through those boxes and get them checked and keep the projects rolling. You may remember in previous meetings we've been talking about what we euphemistically call the Western Finger. There was an area of expansion. We've done a lot of testing up there. There's also a system that's been installed now. We spent north of $500,000 as a pump treat and use system out there that's now available. We can use that water for dust control. Frankly, we've had a hard time finding the high concentrations to pump, but we're continuing to pump that lightly. Again, we're working with the board staff to kind of review the data on that as it comes in and make sure we're addressing that in the appropriate area. A lot of drilling and further investigation in the IRZ area. We've also been working on the lower aquifer. We don't show that plume very often, but it's sort of in the center of the other plumes, and making sure that we don't have any expansion of that. There were some data trends that we didn't like, so we're looking at bringing in some more pumping power to make sure we've got a good grip on that, and that in turn, that water will feed into that ranch IRZ expansion. So getting these getting the AUs expanded is important to us to get that extra hydraulic capacity so we can keep it controlled. And then the other activities, probably the biggest one for the quarter is, we announced at the end of July that we were going to be closing out the whole house water and property purchase programs. We've been doing a lot of outreach on that. We've had about 31 folks who have the whole house water filter units. Those are the boxes that sit outside, and we've contacted every one of them. I'd say we're pretty well through working through all but about five in terms of what they'd like to do with it. There's a lot of different questions about it. I'd say that most folks are opting. Remember that they have both the outside filter, which is the resin that was custom designed for the chrome removal, as well as the inside under sink filters that were RO. Most folks are opting to keep the RO. I think that's a good, effective solution for not only chromium but also for arsenic and other water issues that may be out there. We have found a resin vendor who will work directly with homeowners. Our original resin vendor was sort of an industrial style folks and did not want to kind of sell that resin or deal with that resin to individual homeowners. We found another resin supplier though who will basically that we're setting up those folks who are interested in actually keeping both the water filter and the resin available. I think a lot of folks are opting to forego the resin, but to keep some of the infrastructure out there. There's some good pumps and some storage tanks that are, I think, pretty valuable to a homeowner, especially on a well that might have limited capacity. So all that mechanical equipment that'll increase the reliability of people's wells, I think almost all of the folks are opting to keep that. So, in the next weeks and months or so, we're targeting to have this kind of wrapped up by the end of October. We're going to work with folks and do the plumbing modifications and kind of make sure that we're setting them up in a way that they, want to run those systems for a long time. We've also been concurrent with that. We've announced that we're going to be wrapping up the bottled water program, and so we've been doing outreach to this much larger population of folks who have been receiving bottled water, and letting them know that the vendors that we have right now, Sparklets and Culligan, they will continue to deliver. We've sent out several letters and also followed up with phone contacts. I think we've contacted roughly so far 2/3 of the folks. We have a lot of folks who are away for extended period, away for the summer. We're continuing those outreach efforts to make sure everybody's very clear and that they know this is coming and can make arrangements with those vendors should they choose to continue to receive the bottled water. So, like I said, we've been in pretty heavy outreach mode. Our staff at the community building has been working the phones a lot, and again, the folks with the filters have been coming in. We've been sitting down with engineers and them to kind of go through the little more technically complex details. So I think that's fairly well along. So that's the update that I had. If there's any questions I can answer, I'd be happy to.
Board questions for Mr. Sullivan? No? Mr. Pumphrey? Ms. Cox? Thank you very much. And I believe our last update is coming from Dr. Webster.
Good evening again, board members. Given the hour, I'll be brief, fast, succinct, and visual. So my role each
time we meet is to give you an impression of the community's tenor, how they feel about the project. Also, my role, as you recall, is to basically provide technical understanding, a touchstone for how to answer questions, and also, in the grand scheme, build technical trust throughout the project. It's a tough task, but we stick to it. In my opinion, too, on other projects that I work on, you know, the board understand, I think, the opportunity that the community has to delve into technical topics is extremely high in the Hinkley project. We have regular weekly meetings with the community advisory committee. There are monthly meetings with the full community and various other fielding of telephone calls, etc., one-on-one meetings that you'll see here. And there's a website that we've continuously maintained with the most recent information. For example, all the slides here tonight will go onto the hinkleygroundwater.com. So benchmarking versus other projects, the community portal into the job for transparency is very, very high. I advance the slides by so the I think my I'll give you a grand impression in the next 3 or 4 minutes. You know, I think there are many technical modules and topics within this overall project. You have the slides in front of you, but you know, we've had focus sessions at each of the kind of technical issues, whether it be hydraulic control, plume definition, how the IRZ functions, and we'll continue to educate along these different topics. We've also, as I've explained in other meetings, tried to set the right approach to communication. There's a variety of backgrounds involved in the community. One of the things that is a common ground, I think, for a technical education is the use of models, not the mathematical models that Kevin Sullivan talked about, but the use of three-dimensional physical models that we bring into meetings and actually talk around with a laser pointer. People interact with us. They ask an issue about where there's a hotspot, we point to it in the model, it brings the whole project alive in front of them. So the use of models, for example, the one in the bottom left is of an agricultural treatment unit, the one in the bottom right is a full-size plume, top left is a GIS rendition of the overall plume, and top right there is actually a three-dimensional model of the actual southern core plume, greater than 50 ppb. An interesting kind of dynamic has evolved, I think, in the past maybe 3 or 4 months, where what I've been advising folks to do in this job with a tremendous number of technical topics is to put your effort into particular areas where you think you want to contribute. Everyone can have valid opinions, everyone can have different opinions, but the approach I think that's resonated with folks is, if you've got a particular topic, invest your time in that and we'll work with you to gain your understanding, improve your understanding. And so that's, I think, it's a subtle topic, but I think certain folks are particularly interested in particular areas, and so we've tried to gauge what they are and target our advice to them in these areas. We've also held a community barbecue in the month of May, well attended on a Saturday morning, and we cleared up some things regarding the background study at that meeting. Again, good interaction. On the remark about focus your attention on areas that you're interested in, one of the topics that was routinely brought up in the once-a-month Thursday meetings is the surface issues of the project. I could wax a little bit about all the things we've talked about here tonight are issues that are beneath the ground, 80 feet down to 140 feet down. We can't see them. We can only probe them with monitoring wells and take samples. But the people in the town are impacted by the project on the surface of which we live on. We don't live 80 feet underground. So impacts of the project are manifested in such things as stray dogs, properties that are left behind with no one in them and basically knocked down, and issues like trees that are dying. So there's a group that's got together, and PG&E's put their weight behind this to basically identify areas where there are trees that require to be watered. And so that's an example of a certain community member, in this case Penny Harper, bringing that up with a passion for that and putting her effort into it. We think we can identify other surface-mounted or surface-oriented issues like that that we can put people's attention into, and community spirit will grow again. We've also, as I've talked before, tried on the IRP manager's front to have a higher touch with individuals who have got particular issues. So meetings at their home on individual topics is a regular occurrence. We've also retained a new facilitator. There was a previous lady who participated in that. The CAC thought that another person would do a different job, and so a lady called Annie Schweiker, who's got a past career in industry, has been brought in to help out, and has been through a couple of meetings, and I think the consensus is doing a good job. She also, in the last community meeting, attempted to try it, discuss this above ground, below ground topic, and in the image you see there, folks were asked to post little post-its under various topics on above ground versus below ground topics. And by using this kind of interactive approach with the community, based on the number of stickers placed in the right boxes, we got an opinion of what folks are really interested in. And remarkably, most of their topics are no longer how is the IRZ working, they're interested in above ground topics about their community. The background study, of course, is in the long term, it's a complicated issue. It requires a lot of explanation to community folks. Dr. Isbicki has gained the trust and respect of, like, most community members, and people are waiting with bated breath to see what he comes up with, admittedly in a long time frame. There's frustration, I guess, to some degree that it's taken a long time to get his contract in place, but we're all fingers crossed for a fourth quarter kickoff. There's been the planning of Dr. Isbicki's work has been totally transparent. PG&E, the Water Board, and USGS staff have openly participated even before the contract is signed in scoping the work and building a communal understanding of how the work will be conducted. There's also been some meetings that the CAC has learned about that have taken place in various locations beyond Hinckley, and we've brought the message back to them about the scientific instruments that will be used to try and understand chrome 6 isotopes, etc., etc. There is obviously, Kevin mentioned the fact that towards the end of October, the whole house water system and the bottled water programs essentially will terminate, and some folks are concerned about that, and so especially in this upcoming September meeting we expect to have a lot of conversation regarding that topic, although the pushback and concern is less than I would have expected given where we were perhaps 6 months ago. And the community is interested in becoming sensitized to the topic we talked about kickoff here tonight, which was the modelling work and the forecasting of how the metrics could be put into this grand cleanup and abatement order to basically, you know, hold all parties towards certain cleanup goals in the longer term. So at the last community meeting, especially Laurie Kemper talked about the ultimate plan the board has for basically getting these metrics into a grand, all-encompassing last and final order. So I think it's an overall appreciation the community understands there's a lot of caretaking on the job in their interest, which is can only be a positive thing. And my last slide is that I won't go through this in detail. It was shown to you before, and the reason I show it was I think in my earlier years on this project, I stood up in front of the community and I gave lectures using slides saying, almost in academic format, here is what is going on. We've changed our approach for the vision of higher contact, more one-on-one, use of the models, increased visuals, etc. And I think it has led to a better understanding of the topics. No question, there's still a lot of technical opinion about the validity of certain technical topics and are things working. But it's a healthy debate, and I think we're also trying to introduce a sense of respect into different opinions, that we're all at different points in the learning curve. But I think overall the community is definitely engaged, remarkably so, as I think you've said in the end here, this community's got tremendous tenacity for sticking in this project and wanting to understand, a thirst for knowledge of what's going on. Again, on the above ground versus below ground topics. So I think that's my remarks in conclusion. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I'll start at the other end this time. Mr. Humphrey, do you have any questions? Ms. Cox? No? Down at that end, Mr. Jardine? Mr. Dias? No? Thank you, Dr. Webster.
Thank you.
Now, I just want to make a process check given the hour. Am I making this?
Somebody else's microphone is on, and it's just causing some feedback.
Okay. Ms. Holden, are you going to be here in the morning?
Yes.
So we could move your item over to first thing tomorrow morning? Is that... I know, but it's very late.
Yeah.
But in any case, I think at this moment we will go to public forum, and after that's over, we'll poll the board to see if they can...
There was one comment. Would you want to go to one comment or public forum, which is item four?
Oh, there was a comment on this one.
Part. It was on the status report.
Okay.
Someone else's microphone on the dais.
Dr. Horn?
I'm off.
I was just going to ask for perhaps 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay.
Break.
Okay, there's been a request for a 3-minute break. So we will reconvene in 3 minutes.
It's going to be a long drive home tonight.
Can we talk about doing it as one?
Yeah, I can.
Some people still have to drive tonight, so we want to keep this moving if possible. Thank you. So I apologize. I didn't realize there was a public comment for item number 3, so we'll take that right now. Thank you.
So, Darren Banks?
So, it's directed to the...
That's correct.
Can I just...
Yep.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Either way.
Madam Chairman, board members, Darren Banks.
I'm sorry, Darren, I might have accidentally.
Darren Banks, Hinckley resident. I guess as to item 3, I just wanted to make it clear that you had stated that the MCL only regulates public water systems. Is that correct? And in your presentation?
Not. Not. It's not specifically. The Safe Drinking Water Act requires regulation of all public of water supplied by public water systems. And the Safe Drinking Water Act then requires the department, or in we were the department, the division, to establish those drinking water systems, or primary drinking water standards for the water supplied by public water systems.
Right, so the MCL is a guideline for the public water systems.
It's a drinking water standard.
Drinking water
for
system.
Them, yes.
Okay. That was my only question.
Okay.
Thank you. As it pertains to Lori, I wanted to agree with pretty much most of what she had said earlier, and then want to caution about putting a number based on modeling. I mean, in 3.5 years, I mean, I don't consider myself a complete layman anymore, but it seemed to me that there was a big difference. If you overlaid those two modelings, I mean, obviously... just like Mr. Pumphrey said, I mean, there's issues in that modeling. And PG&E likes to put low values or dismiss the chromium 6 levels that are lower than what they want to tend to acknowledge or what they're considering important. I think that it's important that in that process that those lower numbers be included in that number. I mean, we're talking about a cleanup number, then we need to talk about the cleanup number to clean up their mess, not just what they want to consider as being important from the lowest number to the highest number to the community. They need to get it out. The quarter maps. The quarter maps are still confusing to the average community member, because PG&E puts so much of their opinion or conclusion, it becomes like discombobulated. There's so much going on those quarter maps. This was requested prior to, and I know that PG&E kind of and the board ordered to some changes to that maps. But the quarter maps, if PG&E is going to be allowed to continue to put their opinion on the maps that are supposed to be your guys' orders of how the map is supposed to look, they should be required to make 2 separate maps. They should make a map based on your requirements and a map based on what their opinions are. Because, like I said, somebody that may not know as much as myself or others in the room, it's a confusing map.
Can you give me a specific example of an opinion on their map?
You know, the dotted lines, or you know, they have their keys out on top that explain what exactly, you know, is their additions. But they're really, it all meshes in together. You know, there's not a large disconnect between what your orders are and what they want you or me or anybody else to believe. So, we, as far as phone calls and contacting the community, off the top of my head, I can at least think of three times where we've sat in the room with Kevin and the water board staff and the IRP, and we've all discussed about PG&E says that they continually have issues contacting these people or getting them to agree, and they've all agreed, including Kevin. You know what? We don't have any problem of allowing you to outreach to these people. You know, we can get you the information at some point. Let us have an opportunity to go speak to them. Because me sitting back as a community member, I don't necessarily think that Kevin is lying, but I do think that if somebody that is not a representative of PG&E or even the board, possibly because there was confusion about with Ms. Hernandez when the water board staff went out to do the nitrates, the gentleman didn't identify themselves properly, and that was a topic of interest at one of our CAC meetings. So, I mean, it's a confusion, and so I'm going to tell you guys that several times we've agreed to allow members of the community to go ahead and go out and talk to these people, because for me, a lot of that data that PG&E says they can't get could be important to us in the future as far as the background study. And so, you know, if something can be worked out and at least continue to where we can maybe get that information, whether it's a member of the water board going with a community member or it looks something different than what it is now, so that we can be sure that those people, whatever their reasons are, they understand how important their water may be to the future of the community as far as data. And I have a copy of a plume map, and as PG&E buys properties, that not all of the wells are destroyed, but many of the wells are destroyed as the property goes. You know, the house gets destroyed and it gets piled up over at Avalon Salvage and for the community to see. A lot of the issues and problems with the map is there's that 2,600 yards. Okay, whether it's improper positioning, we can't connect the dots, or what's going on, but there's many wells that are above what this board has adopted as the background number for Hinckley. They're above that 3.1, but the board doesn't acknowledge the fact that there's an issue there. If we're going to establish that background number for the Hinckley Valley, then that number needs to be used to enforce the plume boundaries. And so I just circled a few of them so I can give it to you so you guys can look to see exactly what I'm talking about. At times, whether it's a loss of data due to a house being bought and the well gets covered up, or maybe it's a well-placed data, there's an area in the east that the monitoring well is just far enough to where it's not going to connect to 2,600 feet. I mean, there's little things that, if done properly, the plume size would be much bigger. So that's all I have to just say. Thanks.
Thank you for your comments. With that, we'll move on to public comments. Do we have any orange cards for public comments?
No. I have none. Are there any last-minute orange cards?
There are none.
All right. Well,
can the board handle four more minutes of Ms. Holden?